Okay, we're recording. Finally, we missed the last two classes. Are not going to show up in the audio form on the website because of technical difficulties owing to my own not realizing how to turn. No, I do have a battery. I didn't know how to turn it on. And the first time and the second week, which is last week, I forgot to bring it with me to the challah baking. So both of those audios are not going to show up on the internet, but this one, hopefully, behind her. Well, so, okay. So this is our last class, and we're going to be starting up again January 9th, Mr. Shem. The topic for next term, the unanimous decision of women in Tanakh. Finally, the long-awaited, long-promised course of women in Tanakh. And I'm really very excited and looking forward to doing that with you. So, But I want to start with a quote from Plato. Plato, the great philosopher, who said, "Nothing more excellent or valuable than wine was ever granted by the gods to man." Plato clearly thinks that wine is a very positive thing, that wine is a very good thing, that wine is the best gift that was given to man by the gods, if you believe in multiple gods and all that kind of stuff, which he clearly did. Yeah, so that's also what I wanted to bring, is that red wine, and I'll bring that later on, we'll connect that later on with the class in terms of red wine and health and the connections there. But I want to start out with talking about wine. I want to start out with one caveat. I am not touching the issue of drinking on Purim. We're not going anywhere near that issue of drinking on Purim. You got it? Got it. Okay. You'll see in the context of the class why I get it. Okay.
You're not very upset, are you?
So I want to start by looking at a few sources in Tanakh that really seem to indicate a very clear message about wine. Source number one is in Bereishit Parak Tet, the ninth chapter of Bereishit. The Yubile Noach Yotzim Min HaTeva Shem V'Cham V'Yefet. Noach and his sons leave the Teva, leave the Ark with his sons. The son's name Shem, Cham, and Yefet. V'cham hu avi Kanaan. Cham, by the way, you should know, is the father of Kanaan. Shosha elu b'nei Noach. These are the three children of Noach. U'me'ela naftar kol ha'aretz. And from these branched out the whole world. And now we begin in the box. V'achil Noach ish ha'adama v'itak harem. One thing that I like about this class is it really will bring together a lot of the ideas that we've spoken about already this term. V'achil Noach ish ha'adama v'itak harem. And Noach planted this vineyard. And what happened? Vayish min hayayin, he drank from the wine, he planted the vines, he made the wine, vayishkar, and he became drunk. Vayishgal b'tocha holo, and he uncovered himself in his tent, vayar chama v'kanan, one of his sons come, saw his nakedness, came and told his two brothers. The Mepharshim go nuts over here and say, what does it mean he came and told them? They all say, oh, he came and laughed at his father and teased his mocked his father to them, disgraced his father to them, and said, ha ha, guess what dad is doing in the tent? And the two brothers then walked in backwards with a cloak, covered their father's nakedness, and the story at that point is over. But as a result of this, Ham's descendants, Canaan, are cursed forever. And this is right at the end of the box. Vayomer, he said, God said, Noach said, Arur Canaan Eved Avadim Yu L'Echav. Canaan should be cursed forever, and he should be servants and slaves to his brothers, the lowest of slaves to his brothers, meaning to the descendants of Shem and Yafet, descendants of Shem being Shemites, Jews and Arabs, descendants of, and Christians for that matter, descendants of Yafet being Greeks. So he should be Shem forever, and forever, he says, Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, but Canaan be a slave to them. But Canaan should always be a slave to Shem. Canaan should always be a slave to Yafet. Very bad things happen to Canaan, the descendant of Ham, as a result of this action. And indeed, what's the most significant thing that happens to Canaan as a result of this? Most significant negative consequence?
His land is conquered.
Exactly. Canaan loses the land, the Eretz Canaan, and it becomes Eretz Israel in the soul. In the sole possession of Bnei Israel, of Am Israel. So fine. Source number one, drinking too much is a really bad thing. Source number two. Let's skip to source number three, then we'll go back to source number two.
It's good when they start, that's when they keep drinking.
Right. So source number three is our famous story of Esther.
from the book of Esther, from the first chapter of the book of Esther. If you remember, the first eight psukim are talking about this beautiful party that Ahasuerus is doing to show off all his riches and the carpets and the coverings for his furnishings and all of these things. And it's a several-day party. This is now the second of two parties. The first party was 180 days long. And it seems, by the way, if you look at the psukim, it seems that that 180-day party, no wine was served because it was very probably a military planning party. But the second party is a seven-day party for everybody, like just the regular people to come in. And what happens on the seventh day? Bayom Hashavi'i and Pasuk Yod, Bayom Hashavi'i, Vashti herself had made a separate party for women, and on the seventh day, and I underline the words, Katov Levat Melech Bayayin. When the king's heart was good with wine, what does that mean that his heart was good with wine? Yes, he was quite drunk. Everything looked good for him. Everything looked good to him. Anything that was bad maybe looked good. And indeed, no pain whatsoever. No pain and no shame, because immediately afterwards he calls to his advisors around him and he says to them, come bring Vashti forward in her royal crown. And the commentary says he wanted her to come out only in her royal crown to parade in front of everybody and show off her beauty to everybody else. Which this leads really to Ahasuerus's, the people in the nation really start losing respect from him at this point when he starts making these kinds of decisions. And you'll notice what a large role wine plays in the Esther story, in the Purim story. Where else does wine figure in the Purim story?
When Esther makes a party for the king and Haman.
Exactly, and that's the only way that she could get him on her side. She invites him to Amishtah. What happens when Haman comes to the king and says, okay, here's my plan for these weird people? The last pasuk of Paragimel says that Haman the Ahasuerus Yashvu v'shatu, they sat and they drank, but the city of Shushan was like all messed up, like really depressed and very sad and very confused as to what was going on. But they also did that. Drinking was also involved in that, heavy drinking, that they need heavy drinking to blur, to have no pain, to have no shame, to have no sense of right and wrong. Those are clear results so far we see from drinking. And what about source number two, though? Source number two is the source of the Nazir, the story of the Nazir, which we brought a couple of weeks ago. We brought it the first week, I think. And I want to start from the beginning of Pasuk Yud Gimel, chapter 13. Verse 13. This is the ritual for the Nazirite. On the day that his term as Nazirite is completed, he shall be brought to the entrance of the tent of meeting, of the Yom HaMoed. As his offering to the Lord, he shall present one male lamb in its first year without blemish for a burnt offering, one ewe lamb in its first year without blemish for a sin offering. So the commentaries go nuts. What is this sin offering? Does anybody remember what the Nazir did during the time of his Nazirut while he was a Nazir?
From wine.
Haircuts. Yeah.
Well, from anything grape, not just wine.
Any grape products, including raisins, including, grape seed oil, but like really anything, any products of grapes. Nothing having anything to do with grapes. And we spoke about it at that point. Why is he refraining from anything having to do with grapes at all? And one of the opinions is that because anything with grapes can be intoxicating, and the other opinion is because if you start at one point, how far are you going to go? And to therefore draw the line very clearly all the way at the beginning. So the question we have here now is, okay, here he refrained from grapes. Meat wasn't part of it. He refrained from anything having to do with grapes. He refrained from getting his hair cut, and he refrained from becoming tamei lameit, being impure because of contact with a dead person. So why? You would think that this is like a high level. Here's an ascetic. Here's a person who's removing himself in the physical world to totally immerse himself in the spiritual world. Why does he have to bring a korban chatat? Why does he have to bring a sin offering?
There's other things. He could have spoken lashon hara. He could have...
So for all the other hashim that you did while you were in Nazir, that you should have been totally perfect, but because you weren't totally perfect with everything, then you have to bring a chatat. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Okay. Good. Very possible. What's another possibility?
Because you're human.
And therefore?
The human condition is not perfect.
So that's you're agreeing with what Beth is saying, that he has to bring a chatat because he probably did other things during the time that he was in Nazir.
And afterward, even.
Okay, this is immediately afterwards. This is immediately after he became a Nazir. He was a Nazir for 30 days. And at the end of the 30-day period, he has to bring this Korban Chatat to symbolize the end of the Nazirut.
You're saying that he didn't commit any type of sin during the 30-day period?
No, I don't know. That's what I'm saying. So you're saying possibly, like what Beth said, that it's very possible just for whatever, anything else that he might have done during that time.
Yeah.
Okay, because he's human. Good. Very good suggestion. What else?
He might have slipped. He might have gone off the wagon for one kiddush or something.
Uh-huh. Okay, so he has to bring a chatat because his chait was that he missed not just in, not in general chataim, but particularly in being a Nazir. He wasn't a perfect Nazir.
And maybe he just thought about it. Didn't drink it.
Oh. Then maybe he would have to bring Korban just by thinking thoughts about it. Okay. Good.
So then wouldn't his Nazirut end immediately if he would have had...
If he did, yes. If he broke it, then it would end immediately, but he would still bring a chatat at that point. Whenever the Nazirut ends is when you bring it.
But isn't it also that you're not supposed to be a Nazir, and that was the sin? I remember reading something like that. You're not supposed to abstain from everything like that. That in itself is a sin.
However, he's not abstaining from everything. He's only abstaining in those particular areas.
Well, from those areas. I remember reading something like that.
That's exactly what Ramban says. Yeah. Ramban looks at this whole story and he says, this is nuts. You know, you think that you're on this super high spiritual level because you are completely removing yourself from the physical world, even in just these three things. He says, that is not the way we do things. Remember, Ramban is the middle of the road guy. As opposed to Mr. Yamaguchi, remember the karate kid? He said, you're on this side of the road, you're safe. On that side of the road, you're safe. In the middle of the road, you're squashed. Great, right? Doesn't he say something like that? So Rambam says totally the opposite. Middle of the road is the way to go. He says extremes are always bad. And here your extreme is that you're completely refraining, even though it's only three things, even though it's the only three small areas of life, because you're totally removing yourself from those three areas of life, therefore... this is something that's wrong, and you're bringing Korban Chatat for being a Nazir. Those are bad things to bring a Nazir. That's what Rambam says. Ramban, on the other hand, comes along and says, no, he's bringing a Chatat because he's ending the Nazirut. This is the way that a person should always be. You know, this is a good thing. You should always, you know, be perfectly spiritual and not really involved in the physical world. So he's bringing a sin offering because he's finishing the Nazirut. But let's follow this, what Rambam says. According to the two sources that I showed you, source number one and source number three, wine is clearly portrayed in a very bad way. And throughout the entire book of Esther, it's portrayed in a bad way. We can go through, we saw 2 weeks ago also with Yael and Sisera, that she brought him wine, and wine made him drunk and brought his death about. We can think of countless stories. Can you think of other stories in Tanakh in which wine is involved in a negative way?
But I don't think those are negative ways, because Yael was able to do to Sisera what she did.
So it was good for her.
It was good for the Jewish people.
Yeah, so it was good for the Jewish people. This also with Esther, it was also good for the Jewish people.
Right.
But clearly, objectively, that's not the way that we don't emulate that. We don't look towards Ahasuerus and say, Ahasuerus is so great that he drank so much wine. That's a bad thing that he did. It's something that worked to our advantage, but his actual action was not a good thing.
Right, but... but so we learn that there has to be, you know, there has to be, I can't think of the word. You know what word I'm looking for? No, there has to be, I mean, you have to know when to stop it. I mean, we have
moderation.
We use wine in all of our ritual.
So that's now my next point. Not only do we use wine in all our ritual things, so here we have three examples in which wine is a bad thing. Okay, you can even say, according to the Nazir, that wine is a bad thing. If you say that it's a good thing that he's a Nazir, that he's abstaining from it, that's because wine is a bad thing. Right? Following the Ramban's opinion about it. So now let's look at the next page of sources, which I think is on the other side for you.
That
would work. What?
Moderation.
Yes. Okay. So now, and if you remember also, we spoke about this with wine being a bad thing all the way at the beginning in the first class, and we spoke about what was the Eitz HaDaat, and we presented that it might be a geffen, that it might be a grape vine. And we said that what was the idea about it, of wine being the root of evil, that wine and drunkenness brings about evil things. So we have all these negative sources about wine. But now look into Tehillim Perakuf Tet Zayin, source number 4. David HaMelech says as follows, Kof Yishuot Esa, I will lift up the cup of salvation, uvishem Hashem ekra, and I will call out in God's name. Nedarai l'Hashem Hashalem, I will pay back my vows to God, negdana l'cholamo, in front of his entire nation, in the presence of his entire people. So you look at this, fine. I will lift up the cup of deliverance to invoke the name of the Lord. What do you think is in this cup? It's not Werner's. What do you think it is, probably?
Wine.
Right, exactly. So Rashi picks up on this and he says, oh, from here, I remember there's a Gemara that says as follows. The Gemara in source number 5 says as follows. V'ha amar Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachmini. Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachmini says the following. Amar Rabbi Yonatan. I heard from Rabbi Yonatan. Minayim she'eno mim shira el al hayayin. Where do we know? The context of this is that when do the Levium say shira? When do the Levium, you know, the job of the Kohanim is to actually bring the korbanot, to bring the sacrifices. What's the job of the Levium? To sing while they're doing it. It's a large part of the job of the Levium. Aside from serving the Kohanim and making sure everything's prepared and ready for them, they're supposed to sing. So Rabbi Yonatan says, Minayim she'eno mim shira el al hayayin. How do we know that we only say shira with wine? That they only sing with wine. Shenamar, and he quotes this pasuk. From this pasuk that talks about making God happy, what do people make each other happy with? It has to be wine. So therefore, you only sing with the wine. So now we have this big question. I'm reading this. I said, okay, we have a problem. That's very nice because Rashi quotes this. He says, where do we know? How do we know that there's only that the Levium sing with the wine? From this pasuk, Kosi showed us, Avashem Hashem, I cried that I'm lifting up the cup of deliverance and invoking the name of God. So then I had the question, okay, why don't we duchen on Musaf and Simchas Torah in this shul and many shuls? Why don't we duchen on Musaf and Simchas Torah?
Because it's chaotic.
There's a lot of bad wine.
Which particular people are we concerned about?
The
Kohen. The Kohen is not allowed to perform his duties with wine. In him, with any amount of small amount of wine in him. Now, having said Kiddush for Simchas Torah, I mean, some of them are, you get probably a little drunk. But if you just had a sip of wine or even grape juice, still the minhag is that they don't do it. The custom is that they don't duchen at that point. So if the Kohen isn't allowed to touch any wine, what are you telling me? Like the Levium have to, you know, drink up bottles and bottles of wine before they get up and to sing, you know, so that they can bring the korbanot. It makes absolutely no sense. So Rambam explains it in the source number 6, which is on the left-hand side of the page. It's like across. You see how the source goes across there?
I don't know. You just think winding something. You don't think winding the morning.
Right here?
Right there, yes. Right. And if you follow right here, with the fourth line from the bottom of the Rambam, right, just follow the words Rambam almost exactly across, right here, right at the colon. When do the Levium say Shira? Al kol olot ha'tzibur ha'chova v'yashlam ha'yatzaret be'eit nisuch ha'yayin. The only time the Levium say Shira, says Rambam, is not, when they bring the korbanot, not when they bring just plain the korbanot, when they bring the korbanot and the nisuch ha'yayin. The nisuch ha'yayin is when they pour the wine on the korban, on the mizbeach also at the same time. So that's the yayin that we're talking about. So it's not talking about drinking wine, but using wine, that wine is part of the ceremony. And that the only time that they're going to sing Shira, that they're going to sing and be happy at this point, is the time when they're pouring the wine. So wine already, we see at this point, has a significant part in the ceremony in Beit HaMikdash. So now we move forward to what Beth pointed out. Din Kos, source number 7. Source number 7 is from the Shulchan Aruch, which is written in 1500s by Rabbi Yosef Karo. He has, he divides his Shulchan Aruch into 4 sections. This is the daily life section, Orach Hayim, and he's dealing with the halachot involving a kosh, the kosh shal bracha, the cup of wine that you make a bracha on for Birkat HaMazon, for benching. And says as follows, source in Aleph. Yesh Omrim, there are those who say, Shabirkat HaMazon tu'una kosh afilu biyachid. There are those who say that even one person benching alone should make a bracha on a kos of wine, on a cup of wine while he's benching. Like we say, you know, the bracha at the end of benching, on hagafon. The tarich latzor alav. And there are those who say even that if you miss it, that you have to go over and re-bench. The lo yochal im ein lo kos. Levarech alav. And he shouldn't eat if he doesn't have a cup of wine to bench with at the end. Im hu mechapeh be'eshar shiyelo. If he's expecting that one can come to him, then he shouldn't eat until it gets there. Afilu en tarich lavor zman achilat achat. Even if he has to pass the time of a whole meal, if he knows that wine is available and coming to him, that one person alone even shouldn't eat unless he knows that he has a cup of wine to bench on. Olafiza, and according to this, im shenayim ochlem yachad, if two people eat together, tarich lakachat kol achad kosu birkat hamazon, then each person has to take their own kos, their own cup of wine for birkat hamazon. We don't pass in this way, but this is one opinion, he says. The Yeshomim, and there's another opinion that says, Sheinatuna kos ela beshlosha, that you, the only time you bench on a cup of wine is when you have three people. And those of you who have been to our house for our lunch on Shabbos will know that when we have three men over the age of our mitzvah, we bench on a cup of wine. And that's the reason for it comes from here. The Yeshomim, and there are those who say Sheinatuna kos kala filu beshlosha, and there are those who say even if you have three people, you don't have to bench with a cup of wine. And then we have this little note written by this guy named the Rama, Rav Moshe Isserles. He's the Ashkenazic guy commenting on the Sephardic guy, and his comment is as follows. Umikol makom, no matter which opinion you follow, mitzvah min hamuvchar levarecha hakos. It's a special, special kind of mitzvah to make a bracha on wine. And the Mishnah Berurah, the Chafetz Chaim, explains in his commentary, the Mishnah Berurah, which is right opposite that, right on the same page, to not close, what does it mean? Sheberov ha-tibachot she-tiknu chazal, tiknum l'sader al-kos. Most of the brachot that chazal set up, you should really say it on a cup of wine. Mipnei why? She-kein hu derech kavod, because this is a way of honor, v'shevach, and praise, v'shevach na'en, nice, appropriate praise, HaKadosh Baruch Hu to God, v'sader shivcho u'virchato yibarach al-hakos. To say his blessings over wine, like it says in Tehillim, but what's the connection between lifting up the cup of deliverance and calling out in God's name? That this is a way of honoring God's name by lifting up the cup of wine. You lift up the cup of wine, this is something, this is a very high level drink. We spoke about this with the Isha Sota. That was what she fed her lover. It's like the highest, most fancy drink, and we're waiting here to taste this wine, which I can tell you is not a cheap wine. It wasn't like $7 a bottle, but we'll understand why. She was the woman who was accused of being an adulteress. We spoke about it a few weeks ago in one of the classes. So we have this idea of making a bracha of benching on wine because wine makes something special. Where else do we have this idea of using wine for something?
A wedding ceremony.
Seder.
Probably the brisk.
More regular. Kiddush. And Havdalah.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm bringing you a source, and source number 8, a really interesting source. I brought you like a lot of them. There are a lot of letters in there, so I apologize for that. But I'll explain to you in a moment why. These are the halachot of Kiddush al Yayin, Kiddush on wine. Aleph. Kshayabo leveito yimahir le'achol miyad. When he comes home, he should eat right away. Why? Because he has to make Kiddush. How many of you really eat right away Friday night?
What do you mean by right away?
Like right when it's time, there's mikdash and sit down and eat, not just dally.
You mean right when someone gets home from when you're cooking?
Or if you're not waiting for a man, right when the time is, Shabbos, okay, fine, kiddush.
No, I tend to fall asleep and then game over and they're dying and you get home.
Right, fall asleep. Now, the second part. Nashim chayavot b'kiddush afal pi shuvim mitzvah shesav shas man gvana. Women, too, are obligated in kiddush, even though it is a time-bound mitzvah. And he explains as follows. He goes on to explain. And the little paragraph I put on the bottom, those of you who are interested in understanding further why women are obligated in Kiddush, even though it's a time-bound mitzvah, I brought you the little paragraph on the bottom, which is the Mishnah Berurah, that you can look at that. Okay, so I'm now on the fourth line of source number 8, in Gimel's, right in the middle of the line. In Ein Yado Maseget Liknot Yayin LeKiddush, if a person cannot both buy wine for Kiddush, and to also prepare the needs for his meal and for the evening, for the evening meal and for the day meal, and for Kiddush of the day. In other words, if he doesn't have enough money to buy both wine for both meals and food for both meals, it's the best, if he only has very limited amount of money, the most important thing he needs to do is buy wine for Kiddush at night. There's a very famous story, I don't remember who the rabbi is, but a woman comes to the rabbi and says, Rabbi, am I allowed to use milk for the 4 cups on Pesach night? And the rabbi listens to the question and he says as follows, okay, if she's asking for milk, first of all, clearly she can't afford wine. But what else can't she afford if she's asking to use milk? She also can't afford meat. So what did he do? He took the chicken from his oven, he had two chickens in his oven, he took one and gave it to her and she went home, whatever, you know, that's the whole end of the story. But, you know, the point is that wine is the most important possible thing that you could have. In your whole Shabbos, you have to have the wine. So here we have this two sides. On the one hand, we had all these sources saying that wine is a negative thing. On the other hand, we have all these sources. Not only is wine a positive thing, wine is what makes something really special. We are mekadesh the Shabbos. We make the Shabbos special, something special and different with wine. So how do we reconcile the two? So one way of doing it is, as Beth suggested, is moderation. And I brought you some, if you want to look at it, some sources of wine being good for your health. Wine in moderation is actually even good for your health.
Yeah. That's what they say, red wine.
Yeah, red wine. Is drinking one glass a day for women and up to two glasses. Listen. Drinking one glass a day for women and up to two glasses a day for men may decrease the risk of heart disease, cancer, and stroke.
Can you imagine?
And this is a report that I got from the National Institute of Health, because this is red wine and health. Of course they're going to say something, you know, that red wine is healthy. But this is from the National Institute of Health website. Okay. According to the American Heart Association, some evidence exists that people who drink moderately have heart disease less often than non-drinkers. But the key, could be something, could be other, you know, there could, of course, be other factors involved why they are less, but there seems to be some kind of connection.
And they said to watch and not to overdo it.
But not to overdo it. So the key number one, I think, is the moderation, is to have the, you know, we don't encourage over-drinking. It's the moderation.
They tell you that it's good for you, so you think if you drink more, it's going to
be better. So here, these websites are very clear in saying moderation, only one glass a day, you know, not more than that, but not less than that, whatever. So number one, of course, is moderation. But the other way of looking at it, I think, is what are you using the wine for? What's your purpose of the wine? And we saw this when we spoke about the food with Yaakov and Esav as well. What was the purpose of them using the food? Both Yaakov and Esav had different approaches to the food. Esav's approach is, give me the food now, this is the end, this is all I'm interested in. And Yaakov's approach was, I want the food for the bracha, for a spiritual end, that the food was a means to an end. And here also, what are we using the wine for? Are we like an Achashverosh or like a Noah, who the point is just to get drunk? I mean, personally me, after being in a teva for 180 days stuck up with animals and my whole immediate family, and it's really not sunny outside, you know, I would want to probably get very drunk also afterwards. Mm. That was his end. That was his goal in drinking. He wanted to get drunk and forget about it for a while.
Escape mechanism.
Exactly. And Achashverosh also, he's sitting here with all these people, he wants to, he's getting drunk just for the purpose of getting drunk. But what about, what do we do for Kiddush? And here you see why I'm not discussing for him at all. Here we look at Kiddush though, and we see that Kiddush, that wine is something that's essential to use for Kiddush, because what are you using it for? What are you doing with it? You're being mekadesh. You're saying that this is a special day. I'm giving shabach to Hashem. I'm giving praise to God, and I'm calling out His name. And to do that, I want to use the best, most possible, highest quality drink that is around. If I'm doing it on a drink, it has to be the highest quality that's around. Therefore, I'm going to use wine. And you should know also that the commentators talk about what drinks, if you don't have wine available, which drinks are acceptable to do the different things. No, schnapps is acceptable. Grape juice is acceptable. Schnapps is acceptable. And then less than schnapps, you have juice. If you don't have that, then you have juice. And then, but water is never acceptable, because water is considered the poor man's drink. You're always going to be, the term that the commentators use is called the chamar medina. You're going to always use food that you would serve your guests. So here, the best quality, of course, is the wine.
Yeah.
So there you go.
You know, one time I sort of spoke with one, my father was looking at the label. Is there like too much water in sparkling wine to make a prettier glass?
I don't know. You have to ask your local Orthodox rabbi, although I do know that in Trader Joe's sells grape juice from concentrate with an OU on it.
Really?
An OU parve on it, but it's grape juice from concentrate. And I think that the bracha is hagafen, but it cannot be used for Kiddush or Havdalah. Because it's from concentrate. Yes, from Trader Joe's. Mm-hmm. It has to be, and even though it says on it 100% juice, but if you look on the back, it says juice and water. and great flavoring, mm-hmm. and there are like a few other things in it.
It's a kosher drink, but
it can't. But I think, I believe that you do make a hagafen on it, because I think the percentage
of the fruit,
of the actual fruit, and the fact that it tastes like a grape drink. I think the Star K has a whole thing on their website about it, because there's a whole question with Welch's grape juice, if that can be used for Kiddush or not, when it was kosher for Pesach a few years ago.
Didn't they usually put on the bottle a statement saying that it can be used for Kiddush if it can be used?
So I never seen it yet. Okay, so this doesn't have, Trader Joe's doesn't have it on it. So and I brought it out. I said, oh, here, I have extra grape juice. And everyone at the table said, no, you can't use it. So you can't use grape juice from concentrate for Kiddush. But you can mix it with seltzer, and it's really yummy.
Mm-hmm. One question. Yeah. What you can drink with goy?
What can you drink with goy?
Why you cannot drink with goy?
So the idea of it also is as follows. That when you drink wine, why you can't drink wine with non-Jewish people?
Yeah.
That when you drink wine, that it does change your, you sort of let down your guard a little bit, even if it is a little bit of wine. Like you get a buzz, you know, even from a little bit of wine. And the idea is that while we can and should like goyim very much and enjoy being with them, we are different from them, and we should not be best friends with them. And drinking wine and letting your hair down, in every sense of the word, is something that you only do with your closest of friends. And that goyim should not be our closest of friends, simply because we are, we have different things.
There's no prohibition about drinking something else and barbecuing with them.
I don't know about that.
Never heard that before. That's a halacha?
It's a halacha. I don't think the point is to alter your state of mind. I think the point is to, you know, and even, like, even with the wine, even though it does give you a little buzz, the amount that you drink for Kiddush isn't enough to really make you drunk. As I said, I don't want to talk about Purim.
I think maybe sometimes the Goyish will think that we as far as about how little we drink. A couple times we've had, I had my wedding or my father's bar mitzvahs here. My father's were obligated by some people from the office. Sometimes afterwards, people from the office have commented how little we drink.
How little we drink.
Yes,
sure.
That's right.
Okay, so Mr. Ben-Hain, take it away.
First of all, I want to thank Rabbi Spanier and his wife for letting me and giving me this privilege and honor to speak. I'm not a sommelier, but I've gone expert and I've been in the wine industry for the past 40 years. And this is where my expertise comes from. So I was allowed to speak for about 20 minutes, and I wanted to find out if there were any particular subject we need to talk about, or if you wanted to do something informal. I'm sure all of you have your mystical questions about wine.
And we don't want to get drunk, that's all.
Make sure.
Oh, you want to taste that?
Make sure.
You're not driving.
No,
I'm not driving.
I had asked the routine to select this particular wine, which is a late harvest, and I'll explain later what a late harvest is. I didn't realize how expensive it was. So you're in for a very, very good experience here. So would you like me to tell you just about one? Do you have any particular question you'd like to ask me?
Maybe just about like appreciation, wine appreciation, what you're supposed to look for in wine.
Okay. Why do they always say is it red with meat, white with fish? To me, anything, I think anything with anything that's good.
You're right. Whatever tastes good for you.
Thank you about that.
So, do you know how wine is made? Basically, you think you just press...
Stomp on the grapes. I will see.
First, I'll tell you a little bit how wine is made, and then we'll go from there. How about that?
Okay.
And I brought with me a grapefruit, because I feel that an image is worth 1,000 euros. First of all, the grapes that are picked up usually in the vines are much smaller, and they are much more cared for than the grapes that you buy for consumption. This is not the kind of grape that you would use to make wine, simply because they're too diluted. They're not concentrated enough in sugar to be able to give you a high concentrated wine. So on a vine, usually you can have 5-6 grapes that could grow on the vine. What they do at the flowering season, they cut 2 or 3 buds and maybe only 1 or 2 buds, so that the grapes will maximize its nourishment from the vine. Mm-hmm. So it's like a mother who has 5 children instead of 2 children, it is easier to raise 2 children and feed them properly than to raise 5 children. Am I correct? Mm-hmm. Same thing with the grapes. So if you have only 1 or 2 grapes on the vine, it's easier for them to nourish themselves from the wine and to extract the maximum of the principles nourishment from the vine. So here you have that particular hard stalk which holds what we call the berries. We refer to them as berries rather than just grapes. Okay. And so when the grapes are harvested, they are cut and then they are put in a basket, kind of basket that they carry in the back of themselves, okay, and then they are brought in a big rolling carpet, so to speak, and then there's a machine that separates the grapes from the stalks. Mm-hmm. And the reason is that at the moment when the grapes are going to be smashed or crushed, as we refer to them, we don't want the stalk to impart some of the properties like tannins. The tannins are a chemical compound which would develop astringency to the grapes. And you have that experience of astringency when you let a tea soak a lot in your teacup. Then you have that bitter taste that pokers your tongue, which is referred as an astringency. So you can get a lot of that from the stalk. Mm-hmm. This is why it's separated. In the old times, it used to be crushed with the stalk because they wanted all that tannin. But those were long-lived wines. And the wines today are not made like they used to be, simply because the demand is such that they have to make them in a way where they mature very fast. So they don't want too much of the tannins. They content themselves with the tannins from the pits inside also. If you ever crush the pits from the grape, you notice that it pokers your tongue. You have that same astringency that you find in bitter herbs or bitter tea, right? So they crush the grapes and the peats, right? And smash them. And then naturally in the grape itself, you have on the skin itself plant yeast. Now that plant yeast, usually if you leave it in presence of sugar, it will multiply. It will just multiply. But as soon as you diminish the amount of oxygen, let's say in the tank where the fermentation is going to take place, and the word yeast actually comes from an old word which means boiling. So you have some kind of boiling reaction, but it's not really a boiling per se that occurs. It's just that when the yeast start to attack the sugar to form alcohol and carbon dioxide, as you know, is a gas, and the gas wants to escape. And so you have a lot of gas that forms and looks like the wine is boiling, but it's not boiling. And that's the fermentation process. So the yeast, in presence of less oxygen, start to attack the sugar and leaves out of the sugar, break down the sugar into alcohol and carbon dioxide. Okay? The carbon dioxide usually escapes.
This is just from the grapes, not from adding anything to them?
Not from anything. Now what happens is that if we let the yeast, the natural yeast that are contained on the skins, the plant yeast, yeast is just a plant cell, a very single cell, and that will multiply. So if you let the wine, you know, if you let the juice actually being fermented simply by the yeast contained on the skin, we will not get a very good quality wine. So what they usually do is once they smash the grape, right, what they do, they add a little bit of sulfur dioxide to kill the natural ferments that you have on the skins. They kill them, and then they use raised yeast, quality yeast that is going to impart certain organoleptic quality to the wine. They want certain qualities, so they're going to use certain yeast. And they do the same thing also when they make beer. Because as you know, beer is made out of hops that are fermented, and then they add also the yeast to impart certain quality to the beers. All beers don't taste the same, you notice that, I'm sure. And all wine don't taste the same. Now, each grape has different qualities, you know, aromatic qualities, and this is why different wine tastes differently. So once they press the grapes, the juice is called the must, M-U-S-T, the must. Then the fermentation occurs. If you have about 20% of sugar, you have to expect about 11% alcohol content in the wine, with 20% sugar. Remember that there's 20% of sugar, 50% is going to go into carbon dioxide, into gas. Okay? So sometimes we do what is called amelioration, a nice word, French word for word improvement. Because sometimes you don't have enough sugar, you know. Sometimes the sugar is given to the grape by the sun. More sun you have, the more concentration of sugar you have. So usually before they gather the grapes, they come and they have special meters that they measure the sugar within the grape to make sure that they have reached a certain level of sugar before they crush them. And they measure them in bricks, called BRIX, bricks. That's how they measure the sugar in the grapes. So amelioration that you can have, if for instance the wine is too low in alcohol, they allow to add sugar. Usually they add beet sugar to increase the level of alcohol. Okay. And this process is called chaptalization.
A beet sugar as opposed to a cane sugar?
Yeah, as opposed to cane sugar. Yes, sugar.
Why is it better? Is it?
Because cane sugar is already refined. It has, it can impart the taste to the grape, which we don't want.
Okay.
And the beet sugar is totally absorbed.
Okay.
Thank you. And then it traces. Because mm-hmm. that sugar will be right away attacked by the yeast and broken down into alcohol and carbon dioxide. Mm-hmm. And you know you can make alcohol from practically anything.
Right.
You know, you make methanol, that's how they make, for instance, you know, petrol and so on, alcohol from, or methanol from garbage. That's what they use in cars, for instance. Mm-hmm. You can use trees, you can use anything to make methanol. So all the words that finishes with all, O-L, are alcohol. Yeah? Ethanol, you know, methanol, alcohol, you have a whole bunch of other alcohol. So once all the sugar is broken down, and if the sugar is all broken down, the wine is said to be dry. Meaning that there is no traces of sugar. So when you hear the word dry, we're going to go wine. Dry wine means there is no traces of sugar. And if you feel any kind of sweetness in it, it will be a natural sweetness from the fruit itself.
No sugar in it at all?
All the sugar is broken down by the yeast. That's what we call a dry wine. This is not a dry wine, by the way. This is a sweet wine. Okay?
I don't
know. So, also, you have to understand that once you press the grapes, you're going to have the pits, the grapes, so you have to rack the wine away from the pits and from the skins. Now, in red wine, you have to understand that it is the skin which impart the color, the red, to the wine. There are pigments on the skin that are called enocyanin, and those pigments are dissolved by the alcohol and color the wine. So you can choose the coloration of the wine you want.
If you want to
make a blush wine, for instance, you just leave the skin in contact with the wine for a couple of days. If you want to make a rosé wine, you leave it a little longer, like 3-4 days. If you want to make a red wine, so you leave it longer, like 4 or 5 days.
Red wine is all from, they don't put anything else in it?
No, the color, no. The coloration comes from the skin.
They don't put any color in the red wine?
It comes from the skin. They don't have any color.
Does the skin impart a flavor in the wine?
I'm sorry?
Does the skin give a flavor to the wine?
Yes, the skin also will give some aromatic fragrances and flavors to the wine.
You use different kinds of grapes for different kinds of wine.
Great. Okay. Now, sometimes you will see white wine is only made with white grape, but you can make also white wine with red grape. Because as I said, if I press this grape, the juice that is going to come out is going to be white, not red. Mm-hmm. You understand? Even though it's a red grape, the juice is going to be white.
But what happens with the color?
So you can make, the color is only when the wine has fermented, and the wine has fermented, then the alcohol will dissolve the pigment on the skin. Mm-hmm. You understand? Oh, but if I press the grape now, it's going to be a white juice. So you can make white wine out of red grapes, and you can make white wine out of white grapes. Sometimes you see on a bottle of white wine, you see Blanc de Blanc.
Red wine is from red grape?
You pronounce it Blanc de Blanc, but in French we say Blanc de Blanc. Yeah. So Blanc de Blanc means white from white. In other words, white color from white grapes.
Okay? Red wine is red.
This word Blanc de Blanc has really signification, has a significance only in a very fine champagne. Because in the region of France, in Champagne, they make a champagne out of two different grapes. One is called Pinot Noir and one is called Chardonnay. Okay. So, and Pinot Blanc. Mm-hmm. So if they make the wine strictly out of, they make the champagne strictly out of white grapes, they will call it Blanc de Blanc. And then this wine will be more expensive than the red grapes.
So the type of wine that a Chardonnay comes from Chardonnay grapes, Riesling wine comes from Riesling grapes.
Correct.
Shiraz comes from Shiraz grapes, so that's where they get.
So all the wines that bears the name of a grape are called varietals, because we're talking about variety of grape. Okay, and all the wines that bear the name of a place, like Burgundy, Chablis, and so on, those are wines that come from that they were used. They used from the region of France. They borrowed those names to call them, like a certain type of Burgundy wine or Chablis wine, and so on. Those are called generic wine.
Okay.
They tell you the source from where it comes from.
Mm-hmm.
Generic wine. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You said just maybe just go back to our background. If I wanted to say go back to school and study wines, you know, what would I get, a degree in wines? I mean, like, how
you
do you
get
start?
A degree in enology.
Enology.
Yes, that's the study of wine.
Okay.
And there are university in California, University of Davis,
mm-hmm.
which is a very famous university where you could study the winemaking.
Enology.
So this is just a brief description of how wine is made, but of course there's a lot of other operations and processes, how you separate the wines from all any particles in suspension, sometimes in the wine. Okay, so you do what is called a stabilization first, like a decantation, and you know, all this, the peats and skin get in the bottom of the tank. Then you rack the wine, and then you still have elements in suspension, and then you do what is called a clarification. Usually for an expensive wine, what they do is take some of the wine, mix it with white egg white, mix it very well, and pour the egg white on top of the vat. As the egg white has a higher density than the wine, as it falls down, it picks up all the particles in suspension to clarify the wine. On a cheap wine, they use fish glue. And sometimes they can use gelatin. Gelatin. This is why when you talk about kosher wine, you know, you have to be careful, you know, about kosher, because those are some of the processes that you're not aware. During clarification, they could use non-kosher fish glue, and they could use gelatin to clarify the wine. So it is important. But that's not what makes a wine kosher.
Oh, but what about the mevushal versus non-mevushal? Okay. At what point in the process do you cook it? And
listen, I just want to see what this one is mevushal. Does it say on it? Yes, it's a mevushal wine. So mevushal means cooked, simply cooked.
Do you have just Jewish people preparing the wine?
Kosher wine? Yeah, there has to be one person who supervises everything. to make sure that he's the one who pressed the buttons of the machine that crushed the wallet, so nobody else touch it. Nobody can touch it.
But if it's not Mevushal, I thought even non-Jews can't come in contact with it at all.
That's correct. We're going to talk about that. So Mevushal means cooked. What do you mean by cooked? Do we cook the wine actually? No. Within the vats, we have coils that comes in, and they will bring the temperature to about 86 degrees centigrade, because wine boils at a lower temperature than water. Okay? Water boils at 100 degrees C, and wine boils about 86 degrees C. They do what is called a flash pasteurization. And the reason for that, at the temperature, they kill all the ferments. There's no more ferments left. In other words, the wine will not improve with age, with time. Could keep this one 20 years, it will not improve with time, because the ferments are there. As opposed to a non-Mevushal wine, which doesn't go this called flash pasteurization, which is, has ferments which are alive in it, and the wine will improve with time. But not all wine improve with time. Understand? Every single wine has its own lifespan, just like we all do. You know? I mean, a white wine, for instance, has a lifespan of about 2 years. Some of the great white wines that are made in France and elsewhere will live much longer, because they're vinified differently. When I say vinified, made differently. In other words, they stay in contact with the leaves and the stalks and the peats. They derive a lot of acidity and other chemical compounds in order to lengthen their lives. You understand? Usually it's the tannins and the sugars and the acids that lengthen the life of the wine.
Does it mellow as it progresses?
Yes. As it progresses, it mellows. As a matter of fact, if you were to taste the young wine from the vat, it would be very, very difficult to taste.
It would be very acidic.
Not necessarily acidic. No. It would be, like I said, very astringent. Because you feel the tannins in it. It might be still bubbly. You know, you feel it would be more grapey than wine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it would take time for it to age and start to taste like wine.
Why are sulfites added to wine?
Sulfite is added as a preservative. They add about 18 milligram to 100 milligram per liter of sulfur dioxide to preserve it as a preservative.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, the wine will oxidize very fast.
Does that affect the taste? I mean,
no. Once you open it, you let in the air. Eventually, it will dissipate.
Mm-hmm.
And as it ages, let's say for 2 years, that the wine will use that sulfur dioxide to survive,
mm-hmm.
and then eventually it will go away. As a matter of fact, if they don't put enough, it might dissipate even earlier. And sulfur dioxide is not a problem, except for people who have asthma or have any lung problems, and then they should be careful with that.
And it's very hard to find a kosher wine without sulfites.
And sulfites, even if you don't add them, it's a byproduct of fermentation.
Mm-hmm.
You still will have a little bit of sulfite. Okay? But there are some organic wines. Even it's very hard to find an organic wine without sulfite.
Mm-hmm.
Still be a little bit of sulfite in it to preserve it. Otherwise, it will go back very fast.
What about the shelf life after it's bottled?
Well, if you're talking about Mevushal, you know, there's no shelf life to speak of. Because it's dead. It's a dead wine. So once you open it, you close it, you will keep it in the refrigerator and taste. It should taste the same for a long period of time.
And if it's not open,
Mevushal, you know, within 24 to 48 hours, it will go down very fast and taste. It will oxidize. Because as soon as you start putting the wine, air starts getting in, there's an oxidation process that occurs, and the wine starts to flatten, so to speak.
But I'm saying even before it's opened,
Yes. Sometimes
they change the taste if you've had it for a long time in the bottle.
If it's a Mevushal wine, it should not. If it's preserved properly, unless something goes wrong. Let's say if you let the wine stand in too long, then the cork will dry, air will get in, and the bacteria will get in. If any bacteria gets in, then it will start living on the sugars, on the vitamins and minerals that you have.
Is there something in wine, I don't know, that brings up your taste, that you can taste cheese more sharply? Why are wine and cheese always being served together? Is it a contrast? Does the wine bring up the taste in the cheese?
Good question. Usually you notice that people drink red wine with cheese because they complement each other very well, and also because the fatty acids in the milk, the lactic acid, so to speak, neutralize all the tannins from the red wine.
Oh.
So they do marry very well. They do kind of, you know, complement each other very well. Okay, now I'm going to answer a few questions, and if you want me to go into the subject about wine or wine making, I'd be glad to do that.
So it's best to store the wine on its side so that the cork doesn't dry out.
Yes. Now, the cork, I'll just tell you a few words about the cork. The cork are usually punched directly in the bark. Okay, and they're usually twice the size of the cork that you usually see. When they push those corks, first of all, there is an expert that will come and take a few corks and check them for mold infestation. Because, like you know, if you look at a cork and you break it, you see like a whole nervous system where sometimes mold can penetrate and leave inside of the bark. It's like in a tree, you can have mold that leaves inside. Okay? So what happens is that if you use a moldy cork, eventually the cork dries up because you stood it up, okay? And then the cork starts to brittle, can brittle like powder. If you try to open it, your corkscrew will go through and all the powder will start falling into the wine. So what happens is that if the cork is moldy, then the mold starts falling on the wine and the mold will leave out of the wine and will give it a tint. It's called the cork tint. And the wine will taste corky and will taste moldy. And if you can smell it right away on the cork even without touching the wine. This is why you see other people smell the cork, because they can see right away whether the cork has been infested. Because even the little bit of wine that touched the cork, the molds are living on that, and right away you can smell it. And then of course when you smell the wine, and this is why people smell wine, not because of snobbery or whatever, to see whether the wine is clean, is not infected, because the wine can be affected in so many ways. It can take vinegar first. So you have aromatic acid, we sometimes give you acetic acid, and then acetic acid is how you make vinegar. So you can smell it, by the way, in a glass. Or you can smell the cork, the moldiness from the cork. You can smell also some funky things, you know, like it smells like asparagus or some vegetarian smell, something which is not normal for wine. You should be able to smell the particular fragrances of that particular grape that you're tasting.
When you buy a $7 to $10 wine, what is the difference between that and that
$21.99
one?
Let me see if I understand your question. What difference is there between a wine that costs $10 and one that costs $20, let's say? First of all, you have to understand that let's say if I take a French wine, between the producer of this French wine and the retailer, there are six intermediaries. Each one takes his cut. So that bottle of wine probably left France at $2 and is getting to your table at $10. Because first of all, you have a broker who is going to be between the producer and the buyer. Once it gets here in the state, after it clears taxes and so on, it goes to a wholesaler. The wholesaler will sell it to retailer, retailer to consumer. And, you know, each one may decide to take a different cut. One may decide to take 15%, then 25%, 35%, 50%. So you cannot go by the price. Sometimes you can buy a bottle of wine at $10 that tastes much better than the wine that costs $25. So what really makes the price of the wine is offer and demand. You cannot produce wine like you produce scotch. If you have a small vineyard, you can produce so many bottles of wine in a vineyard, and there is such a demand, your price will be very high. If you have huge vineyards, right, and you can produce a lot of wine, then you can bring the price down. So it's really offer and demand. You have some bottle of wine that fetch $2,000-$3,000, and people buy them by the case.
I want to taste it, yeah.
You know? If you want to see some of this wine, I can send you to a store here. In Michigan, you can see some of this wine. The person who says of wine doesn't tell anybody that he has this wine, but the wine might be hijacked. But only the people who have money who knows what they're buying you know. Otherwise, the one I expose there, each bottle of wine could cost $2,000 or $3,000 each.
Wow.
Yes. Each bottle.
Do they drink it or just say that? So they can say that they have $3,000 bottles.
Well, it's a very good question. If it's a very young wine and they have a nice cellar, they probably will keep it. Because a lot of these wines are for keeping.
Stats and milk.
You know what, guys, I haven't been here for all classes, but I've enjoyed them as I've been here. I didn't know Rena. Yes, you can.
Thank you.
Do you have any other questions?
Can you tell us, like, some of the better kosher wines? Like, what's a red Cabernet?
Yep, okay. You have a preference of red over white?
I'm just curious.
First, for your health, the red wines are much better.
Yeah,
okay, because the red wine are in contact with the fruits, with the skins, and they give out much more fragrances and much more properties from the skin of the peach than the white wine does. The red wine usually spend very little time in contact with the skin and the peach, and they separate it, they filter it, and they sort them. And the red wine, they are usually aged for some amount of time, and they spend much longer time in contact with the skin and the pits. And so it has a lot of elements, antioxidants, B-complex vitamins, and that will help, for instance, getting off your cholesterol. If you have problems with cholesterol, it's very good. And I'm sure you've heard, all of you, you've heard about a very powerful antioxidant, which are derived from grape seed called pycnogenol. Okay. The pycnogenol is a very powerful antioxidant.
This is for women only. Think about it when you say Shalom Atani Isha tomorrow morning.
Sorry.
Aviva, come on in. There you go.
So what's a good red wine? Kosher red wine.
Okay. The price is no
issue. Yeah. No issue.
Okay, so Bayer Zod has some very special Cabernet, special reserve. That costs about $50 a bottle. That's the most expensive one I saw. This is among, the top, but this is a white wine, a dessert wine. It's one of the top dessert wines that you probably will find around. I would definitely recommend Yarden, which is a winery in Colorado Heights. And it's excellent, but be careful with the other because it's non-Mérouchal. So a non-Mérouchal wine cannot be touched once opened by a non-Shomer Shabbat, even a Jew, so not alone a goy. Yeah. So if you're going to serve that, you have to make sure it's served by a Shomer Shabbat person. It's interesting, we had a very expensive wedding at Bocoin, and the person had brought some wine from France that he shipped out from California. Each bottle of wine at wholesale price was $160. And so we had a problem because the wine was non-Mérouchal, and they had a big party, and we wanted to use this bottle of wine. So we had to bring a lot of Yeshiva Brachot to serve the wine. And to make sure that nobody touches the wine.
I thought it had to be somebody.
You could just simply show the wine. You were not allowed to touch the wine or whatsoever. They could not because the wine was not Mérouchal. And those glasses, we had to order special glasses because if we had used his own glasses, then they would have to go to the mikveh again.
Really?
You might go to the mikveh before then. Because a lot of non-kosher Jews would touch the glasses.
Can we taste?
Yeah.
Can you
say
anything about
wine?
I don't remember what you said about your
background. I was in the wine industry for 22 years.
Making wine?
At all levels.
So when you say you're not a sommelier, what does it take to be a sommelier?
A sommelier is a very specific job.
Okay.
When a person is learned to taste wine, is trained to taste wine, to recognize the wine, different grapes and so on and so on, and what he does, he works in a restaurant, and usually recommend the wine with the particular dish. Basically, it's not easy. It
doesn't mean he's a wine expert. It's not a blanket term.
He should be a wine expert.
It's not a blanket term for a wine expert.
Yeah. But he has a specific profession.
Okay.
If you're going to have, let's say, a big dinner party, I said, I have people like, you know, different kinds of wine to go with different dishes. That isn't really necessary. You don't have to blow a big wad for wine, do you? That's a low amount of money. You just do what you're comfortable with, right?
Yeah, you want to make sure, you know, there's certain wines that you don't want to serve with certain dishes.
Mm-hmm.
That's important. Certain wines you don't want to serve with certain dishes.
What wines are called dishes?
For instance, okay, there are some basic rules, and there's a reason for that. And I'm going to use some basic rules, okay? Usually, red wines, we serve them with red meat.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and the reason for that is that meat itself usually has a lot of fat in it, and would be very good with the tannins of the wine. It will definitely counteract the tannins of the red wine and bring out the flavors of the red wine. So you would have a white wine with red meat. White wine you could have with white meat, for instance, could be veal, right? It's a white meat. Chicken, for instance. But you can also have a red wine. You can have also a light red wine with white. Okay? Fish usually would have a white wine because usually white wine has a greater acidity than the red wines, and the acidity will cut through the fattiness of the fish. So usually you would want a white wine with fish. And usually dry wine with fish, not a sweet wine. Those are basic rules. But again, you can go whichever way.
What about with like pasta?
Pasta, red wine would go well. A light red wine. You know, the Italian drinks, like one like Barbaricella, Barbolino, you know, very light red wines.
Okay.
So, just a few pointers here. Yes. Usually the French people, when they have a meal, a full course, three, four course meal, they always serve salad last. And the reason for that is that they don't want the acidity from either the vinaigrette or lemon that you put in your dressing to interact with the acidity of the wine.
Uh-huh.
And definitely, if you have your salad first and you taste the wine, you're going to find that the wine is too acid because the acidity from your dressing is going to interact with the acidity. This is why the French always have the salad toward the end, because this is when they have the cheese with the salad and red wine. Okay?
At that point, drink a lot of wine.
So you don't want to have also wine and eggs. If you have an appetizer with eggs, you don't want to serve wine.
Wine.
It just doesn't go very well with eggs. I don't. It doesn't go with eggs. When I say eggs, it might include mayonnaise. You don't want to serve wine with that. Yes.
Huh. Even though it's
bad. Yeah, even though it doesn't go very well. Eggs do not. They practically kill the taste of wine because they're very cloying. They cover your tongue. You have to understand all your taste buds are in your tongue. You have about 10,000 taste buds in your tongue, and the tongues. Remember, the tongues only answer four different flavors. Sweet, sour, salty, and bitter.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and the taste buds are spread in such a way that the sweetness has been the tip of your tongue, the bitterness in the back of your tongue, the saltiness on the side, saltiness on top, and acidity on the side.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever you think you're tasting the fragrance, it's only because of the connection between the olfactory nerves and the back of the throat, right? And your mouth. Sometimes you feel certain flavors simply because there's a good connection between the back of your mouth and your olfactory nerve. But really, the tongue can only answer for four tastes, and the nose can answer up to 200 different fragrances for a trained nose.
So when someone says it's very oaky, or you know, the wine is very oaky, or they taste the cherry.
So when we say wine is oaky, you have to understand that red wine, the expensive red wine, they spend a certain time in what's called Limousin cask. Okay? And so they usually those casks are brand new, and they're going to derive a lot of the tannin from the oak cask. Usually it's oak. And so those tannins will mellow with time and will transform into vanillin. It will give you like a vanilla kind of flavor in the wine, mm-hmm. if you let it mellow long enough. If it's very oaky, and people like this oaky taste, which is a very, very young wine, it really needs to mellow a lot.
Mm-hmm. Thank you,
Father. Okay.
Thank you.
Sorry, you want to go ahead? Yes, 2 minutes.
You're missing the taste of wine.
You don't eat Ed's wine. I know that the NCSY every year, they call it champagne brunch, and they used to do like eggs and things with the wine. Can you give us 2 minutes on champagne? What's the difference between champagne and red wine? More bubbly, or what do we do with champagne?
Okay, that's a big question.
I know.
That's a good question.
Very slow, very abbreviation.
Now, in the champagne process, you may wonder how this bubbling wind up in the bottle. Is it added through form of gas? Or what happened?
Mm-hmm.
The thing is that when you make the wine, in other words, after you pressed your grapes and the must, in other words, the juice has turned into wine and you're filled in the bottle, you're going to have inside the bottle all the sediment and fermentation. So what happened is that the wine still has sugar in it and then fermentation continues in the bottle. Now, we said that one of the byproducts of the fermentation process was alcohol and carbon dioxide. Now the carbon dioxide is trapped in the bottle, cannot escape in any way. So it's going to dissolve into the wine and give it those bubbles. But of course there are other processes when you make bulk wine, when you make bulk process where you force the carbon dioxide artificially to the wine to make what is called sparkling wine. So sparkling wine is then going to what is called champagneization, which is a double fermentation and opens in the bottle.
When people open the wine and they say they have to let it breathe, what exactly are they doing?
Good. So let's say you want to drink a wine which is 5 or 6 years old. Okay? Let's say you drink a 1995 wine today, it's like 8 years old. The wine has been imprisoned in this bottle for 8 years. Right? In other words, not being in contact with the air whatsoever. So when you let the wine open, or you can even breathe in your glass, which is better, what happens, the oxygen of the air enters the wine and will react with the esters of the wine, which are chemical compounds, which are formed between the acids and the alcohol. And the reaction of the air with the ester, called esterification, give an oxidation process whereby it frees the bouquet. That's what you call the bouquet. So you're going to start smelling the bouquet of the wine. So you let it breathe. If it's an old wine and sometimes it's too old, you don't want it to breathe too long because it will die out very fast.
So most wines that we would buy
are very young, they're only breathing. They're only breathing because they're all 2 or 3 years old, they don't breathe. Besides, you would say that of a wine which is alive, you know, but if it's a Mittelschale wine, it's a dead wine. So what I'm doing now, I'm trying to open the wine, and usually if you want to open the wine, you want to make sure you cut under the lip of the bottle. There's like a lip which is formed here. You always want to do that under the lip. Some, not now, but in the old time, they used to use lead for the covers of the bottle. So if you didn't, let's say if you cut the bottle of wine on the first side, on the first lip, when you pour, you always have the alcohol in contact with the lead, and you'll get the lead in your glass. You understand? But if you cut it in the second lip, then you wouldn't have that problem. But nowadays they don't use lead. They use sometimes very light plastic film or aluminum film, but they don't use lead anymore. So that's what I mean by the lip, okay? I'm talking about this lip, not the first one, the second. A lot of restaurants, sometimes they open the wine on the first lip, tell the waiter to open the second one, same lip. Not because you don't want the wine to be touching the whatever metal you have there.
So you should start making kiddush in glass cups instead of silver.
I'm sure you've seen this.
That's why they put gold.
You've seen this kind of waiter corkscrew.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Some knows how to use it, some don't. It's a very simple principle. Once the cork is inside, right, you have like here for this side here, which is going to rest on the neck of the Bala here, and it's going to create like kind of a lever system, you know, just lever system. Use this as a lever, which I'm going to show you now. Usually this is called a worm. In some of the red Bordeaux, the cork is sometimes much longer than that, and you would need a cork which is much longer. This is too short, really. This corkscrew is more for Burgundy bottled wine, where the cork is shorter. So you try to put the worm with a pin right in the center, mm-hmm. not on the side, otherwise you're going to have problems when you want to open the bottle. So what right now what I'm doing is twisting very gently. There's not really much force which is applied. Okay? Now, as you see now, this is resting on the tip. So when you open, you don't want this to be too inside because it can tear the cork. So once you lift it up a little bit, you want to move this a little bit. See, it's a very simple process. And very often you will see the person who opens it hold the cork like this and twist it lightly.
I want to ask you a question about the cork.
Yeah.
There's a school of thought that says you should have your bottles of wine laying down so that the cork stays moist and doesn't dry out.
Yes, we talked about that.
I went to the other
school.
We
mentioned that before. You want the cork always to be wet, so as not to let the air come in.
So always and every buy from the store.
Yes, about 45-degree angle, it's fine. Some people have them standing like this, outside, it's no problem.
Okay.
The idea is to always keep the cork right, but as I said, like this 45-degree angle is enough.
So that's why the wine racks are all...
Yes, that's uh-huh. why they're all flat also. And of course, it's important where you store your wine. Okay, if you're going to buy some wine for keeping, of course, you're not going to buy a Mebuchadnezzar wine for keeping. You don't need to. Just go to the store and buy it whenever you need it. There's no point in letting the wine sit here. If you're going to buy it, if you're thinking of eating a wine cellar and you want to buy some fine wines which are non-Mébouchon and have them age and so on, that's a different story. Then you want to keep them in a place which is very dark because you don't want light to affect them. This is why this bottle is dark, because even a little light will be sufficient to oxidize the wine. So as a matter of fact, when you buy wine in the store and you see there's neon light all over, always take the bottle from the back, not from the front, because of the oxidation process. Now the reason I brought this glass is to show you what a glass should look like. It should be very clear with a long stem. You never hold the glass by the bowl, because you don't want to wound up the glass, you want to buy the stand, this is why you have the stand. Mm. It has to be very clear so you can see the color of the wine, and the color can tell you a lot about the age of the wine. When it's very, very young, it's light, strong yellow. And as it ages, it becomes more yellow, and then as it goes downhill, it starts to turn to brown, and it starts becoming oxidized. So the color tells you a lot about the wine. Here you can't tell anything about the color because the bottle is green. And it is done this way so as to protect the wine, because it's an expensive wine. So when you feel about the wine sitting for the purpose of tasting, so when you pour wine, pour enough for the tasting. Just don't pour one drop. You have to pour enough, because when you're gonna taste the wine, you want to put enough in your mouth to be able to taste it. With your tongue, you can feel the weight of the wine. You then let it rest for 30 seconds so that you let all the tongue. The tongue is a pompous organ, and it will absorb a lot of the wine. You won't let it sit for the wine. This is why you can't even taste Nesach wine, because your tongue will absorb a lot of the Nesach wine. You know. So usually you see people swirl the glass like this. How do they do that? It's because they force the air into the wine so as to accelerate this reaction of esterification, which we talked about, where the air will tease, so to speak, the esters of the wine and free the bouquet. So you'll see them swirling the wine like this and then smelling it. You see particularly the nose inside of the glass that they want to capture, because the glass itself is tapered so that to trap the bouquet inside, not to let it out. This is why, because it's like a bowl, and should, then it is narrow and curls a little bit, so it has to travel, okay? And when you breathe the wine, you breathe very, you know, very, very gently, very slowly, and deeply, you know, when you smell it. And you want all the aroma to attack all your olfactive nerves. You know, you want to impregnate the olfactive nerves. And then you'll see people again when they taste wine. I'm going to make some funny noise. You may laugh, of course. But there's a reason for that, too. What you just heard now, to let more air enter in your mouth so as to have again the same process of esterification in your mouth, to let air come in and free more bouquet in your mouth so that there is more contact with your olfactive nerves. Okay? And usually they don't swallow, they spit. Because if you swallow only once, it's enough to impair your judgment. So they usually don't. If they have several ones there to taste, they don't swallow. They speak to them. Even if they love the wine. At the end, when they finish, then they go back to the one that they like, mm-hmm. and then they taste to their own pleasure.
They have to take a drink of water in between, or because from taste to taste.
From a piece of bread or water, yeah. wash their mouth, and they know what. If it's a wine which is rich and cloying and sweet, and then you know you're going to go to a dry wine, usually don't do that. You go from dry to sweet, and you go from light to heavy wine. Because if you start with a heavy one, all the other ones are going to taste clean.
How can such a small amount of impair your judgment when there's not enough alcohol in it?
But there isn't enough that's going to be absorbed. Hmm. Enough absorbed to impair judgment. Now, people say a lot of things about wine. As you see, for instance, sometimes it forms what is called legs. You know, you see them falling very slowly. Depending on how fast or slow those legs are formed here, that you see here, falling slowly, it tells you about the amount of glycerin that the wine has, and the glycerin relates to the sugar content. Not only that, it tells you also about the acidity. If those legs form very fast, and they fall very fast, that means the acidity is high. If they go very slowly, then you know it's very glycerinous and very rich in sugar, and it's not that acid. So, the color, you know, in your eyes, and your nose, and your tongue can tell you a lot, you know. Even just looking at the wine, you can learn a lot. Usually also with red wine, you see people going within the white background to look at the wine like this so that they can see more of the color of the wine and see also some imperfection. Sometimes the wine could be hazy, so that a film could form on top, could be a bacteria infestation. And there's nothing wrong also in the nose, you pick it up right away, there is any kind of infestation, bacterial infestation. It could smell sometimes like rotten eggs, sulfur dioxide, sulfuric acid, or acetic acid, if it's time to turn to vinegar. Did you see the cork starting to expand? This is why sometimes you have difficulty putting it back, because this cork, before it was put in, was twice the size. What they do usually is that it soak in the wine for a while so it becomes softer, and then you have a machine that compresses the cork very hard, and when the bottle, during the bottling process, when the bottle comes into the cork, you have a hammer that hammers down the cork inside. But usually it's twice the size. But then with the time, the cork starts to take the shape of the opening here. But then when you take it out, it wants to expand again. So usually use the opposite side, which is a little smaller, you know, right. And because this one was on top.
I know that it's late, but just one quick thing. How do Americans compare, with our European brethren when it comes to wine? I think more wine does come from Europe. Are they really more wine snobby over there in Europe than we have here?
No, I would say in America they make great, great wines. And America has, even though it's a young country, they have developed technology that in Europe they didn't have.
Huh.
In other words, they weren't willing to analyze chemically the wine and to be able to control all the aspects of winemaking. But France, in Europe, they had knowledge from generation to generation.
More
with the winemaking, but not so much with the technology. And through the technology, the Americans have been able to make wine which are absolutely outstanding. But they use practically the same varietals. You have to understand that in Europe, all the vines were totally devastated by a louse which was called the phylloxera. And this was brought actually from America. One day somebody came, brought a vine from America, he wanted to use it in Europe, and all Europe was totally devastated by this louse. And then what they had to do is bring vines, plant vines from America, and graft them into European vine. So most of all the vines in Europe, they grafted onto American rootstock.
Can you see like the green light there on the cork? That's not mold?
No.
Could you have smelled it already?
Yes, I know. Now sometimes you could find, sometimes on the white wine, see like little crystals. This may happen once. So this has to do that at the stabilization process of the wine. What we usually do stabilization process, they have like coils that goes into the vat that I explained to you. Instead of running hot water, they will run very, very cold water. And this cold water will precipitate some of the calcium and potassium tartrates, which will form into a form of crystal. And then that wine, after that, they will filter the wine and separate them from these crystals. But very often they do that with more expensive wine than with cheap wines. So what happens, sometimes you can have a bottle of wine, cheap, regular wine, that was exposed to cold, and those precipitates would form in the bottle. But you have to understand that they will not affect the taste of the wine in any way, and they're not dangerous for your health at all. So if you see them, then let them go to the bottom and drink your wine normally. They will not affect the wine in any way, and they're not dangerous to your health. Don't think that there's something wrong with the wine.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So let me pour some more.
Thank you.
Now this wine is still very, very young. It hasn't had a chance to mellow, and I'm not sure to what extent it will mellow because of them.
Mm-hmm.
You can see that the color is pretty.
Smells really good. Really strong.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't it?
Really strong. That's not strong. It's really strong.
To me. I mean, you have to realize what I'm used to drinking.
Yeah, 25.
Yeah, it's good. You want to keep having
No,
actually, I drink
Rossi.
I drink Rossi.
So this
is what?
This is
a light white wine.
This is 12% alcohol. Rossi might have 6%. Rossi may have 6% of alcohol.
Rossi has about 5,
5%. But to give you an idea, the difference of a shot of scotch or vodka or anything? I mean, whiskey or scotch and so on would be about 46% of alcohol.
And what percentage is
there? This is only 12%. It's very, very low. Remember, it's 12% for the whole bottle. So when you drink it a little bit, you're not drinking really much.
Why does it smell sour?
It's very sweet.
What?
It smells sour to me. Like there's a
sour.
No, there's a sour smelling smell of it. Not that it smells bad, but
actually, you're smelling the grape itself, uh-huh. Riesling. Right. I don't know whether the plastic itself is involved in the smell.
I'm not smelling the plastic.
Yeah, this plastic has a smell of itself. Which I won't get in my glass.
It's good.
It doesn't taste sour. Yes. It's a Riesling. It's very good.
It doesn't taste like. It's okay.
It doesn't
taste
like really good. Just describe it. You know something that just go with the cookie? I did forget to mention before.
This is more dessert wine.
That if you make Kiddush on a Kedem Malaga or whatever Kiddush wine you make it on, and then you drink a Riesling later in the meal, you have to make a bracha of Hatov HaMeitiv on the Riesling because it's a much better quality wine. There's a special bracha.
Really?
That you make.
Really?
Yes. When you drink a higher quality wine, like when you make Kiddush on grape juice, and then you drink a fine wine during the meal, you have to say bracha of Hatov HaMeitiv.
I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have that problem. I just like the kiddush, and that's it.
Okay.
I just started drinking that one.
Very good.
Very good,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You
guys
have
any
problems?
This is really, thank you. Very good choice. And thank you for your
presentation. Thank you. Thank you.
No.
Why not? I'm on a diet.
Just taste it.
Just taste it.
If you really taste it.
You're tasting your hand.
Hold it down there. It's another bag of
stem. Although in this one, the stem has a physical.
It's very rich. Very flavorful. Wonderful.
Not the
$3.99
wine we're
using. No,
not really. I'm sorry, I ran
out of camera.
Keep that
in the
bag.
Keep that in the bag. It's much cheaper.
It was about $17.
$17. I want to thank Danielle for making the time very much. Is this considered a good wine? Like, would a wine connoisseur like this wine? You like this wine? This is the best you can get here.
In
New York, is this wine?
No, in New York, it's fine.
That's better.
Cloverleaf is the special wine here. Cloverleaf?
I'm not coming in.
It's on Northwestern Highway.
Where is it?
Applegate Square. My dad gets a lot of extra wine from there. So if you tell him, my dad doesn't like that taste, but
he's
not. I don't know. But you have to ask him, because he'll bring what you want, but you have to ask him.
Are you getting, 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 are you get